and full-bodied sound of the Trio Wanderer, their encore there at this live Wigmore Hall lunchtime concert, the last movement of Dvorak's Dumky Trio. Well, the Trio Wanderer are now off to Kuala Lumpur. In a few days' time, they're playing Beethoven's Triple Concerto with the Malaysian Philharmonic Orchestra. Meanwhile, we can look forward to next week's Monday lunchtime concert here at Wigmore, the tenor Toby Spence and pianist Julian Milford with their account of Schubert's Schwanengesang. Till then, that's all from me at Wigmore Hall, and on to Broadcasting House.
That was Sarah Moore Peach, and she'll be back later on this afternoon with this week's edition of The Choir. That begins at 4 o'clock. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just after 2 o'clock, and it's time now to join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show. Paolo Pandolfo playing the viola da gamba in the prelude from a suite in D major by Carl Friedrich Abel, who's the subject of today's early music show. It's a German-sounding name, of course. Abel was born in 1723 in the city of Kirten, just southeast of Berlin. But he was also one of the many composers and performers, like J.C. Bach and Handel, who gravitated to London in the mid-18th century to capitalise on both the musical and the financial riches this growing, prosperous city had to offer. London was certainly the place to be. It led the world in the whole concept of public concerts, and audiences flocked in large numbers to hear some of the best singers and players perform in the new purpose-built concert halls that had sprung up in what we now call the West End, not far from Oxford Street, in fact. But what was Abel up to before he made his mark in England's capital? Well, he certainly had a good start in life as far as music was concerned. His father was the principal gamba and cello player in the court orchestra at Kirten, taking over from none other than J.S. Bach when he moved on to bigger and better things in Leipzig. In fact, it's pretty likely that Bach wrote his own three gamba sonatas for Abel Sr. to play as a teaching method for their joint patron, Prince Leopold. Young Abel almost certainly studied the gamba with his father then, and he proved himself to be quite a chip off the old block, becoming a virtuoso on the instrument, as well as teaching himself to play the keyboard. The Bach connection doesn't end there, though, because on his father's death, the teenage Abel was sent to Leipzig to study at the Thomasschule, the choir school where Bach was then the head cantor. Naturally keen to encourage the talented son of his old friend, Bach not only taught Abel for the next 5 years, but recommended him for his first job at the court in Dresden, where he joined the orchestra under the formidable Johann Hasse. Here, and for the next 15 years, Abel really honed his skills as a professional gamba player and began composing, especially for his own instrument. Thank you. a fugue from the Suite in D Major by Carl Friedrich Abel. It was played there by the gamba player Paolo Pandolfo. You're listening to The Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. Today's programme isn't only about the gamba, though. In fact, by the mid-18th century, this six-stringed cousin of the cello was already beginning to decline in popularity. And Abel soon started to compose for other instruments as well, especially the flute, which isn't surprising since the Dresden Orchestra could boast two of the greatest flautists of the day, Pierre-Gabriel Bouffardin and Johann Joachim Kvantz. This is the first movement of Abel's Flute Concerto in G Major, played by Georgia Brown with the ensemble Nordic Affect.
Thank you.
Georgia Brown was the soloist in the first movement of that Concerto for Flute and Strings No. 5 in G major by Carl Friedrich Abel. The orchestral parts were played by the ensemble Nordic Affect. After 15 years at the court in Dresden, Abel began to spread his wings a little. And it was undoubtedly a sensible moment to make his exit, because 1757 was the year of a devastating siege on the city at the hands of Frederick the Great. Many of the court musicians were forced to look elsewhere for employment, and Abel moved on to Mannheim and then to Paris, where he learnt some of the new musical fashions of the day. Eventually, though, he turned up in London, and in keeping with the custom of the time, announced his presence by immediately giving a public concert where he performed many of his own compositions for the Gamba. It was a great success, and he was soon in demand all over the town. And it wasn't long before the call came from the highest realm, King George, no less, who appointed him chamber musician to Queen Charlotte, with an excellent salary of 200 a year, and also granted him a royal privilege, which gave Abel the right to publish his own music in England. Abel was quite a shrewd businessman. He'd already signed and sealed some pretty lucrative publishing deals on the continent, so these new opportunities in London must have helped to set him up the career ladder very nicely. Shortly after, Abel published a set of 6 trio sonatas in London. Their style reflected some of the pre-classical music he'd heard on his travels in Europe, very cutting-edge for their time, and we go to hear the first of them now. Opus 3, No. 1 in G major, played here by London Baroque. Thank you.
Thank you.
London Baroque with that trio sonata in G major by Carl Friedrich Abel, published in London in 1761. It must have been exciting when Abel heard, just a year later, that an old family friend, one of his old teacher's younger sons, Johann Christian Bach, would be joining him in London. The two musicians quickly became firm friends, and in 1764 they set up what was to be England's first ever series of subscription concerts. They were certainly in the right place at the right time. This was just what London needed, and the Bach-Abel concert series ran for 16 years, the two of them performing between 10 and 15 concerts a year themselves, not only promoting compositions by some of the leading musicians from all over Europe, including Haydn, by the way, who premiered many of his pieces in the series, but of course also promoting their own works as well. For 10 years, the concerts were hosted by a Mrs. Teresa Cornelis, a retired Venetian opera singer and one-time lover of Casanova, who owned a concert hall at Carlisle House in Soho Square, then the height of fashionable events. As the Bach-Abel concerts became more and more popular, they moved into larger premises, and by 1776, they settled in the new Hanover Square rooms, just off Regent Street. On the ground floor was a tea room, offices and a foyer. Upstairs, the concert hall, considered to be the height of elegance, could accommodate almost 900 people, which sounds a bit like it was on the lines of today's concert halls, except that this hall was decorated with paintings by Cipriani, Gainsborough and others, painted in a specially translucent way so that the light from hundreds of candles would show through the canvases. What a magical way to listen to music. One of the new trends that grew up in London around this time was for the piano concerto, inspired by a revolutionary new instrument so tiny that it could only be accompanied by a string trio. The square piano's new halo of resonance added a wonderful richness to the ensemble, but with virtuoso scales and trills it could also stand out like a true soloist. The new square piano, as created in London by the German instrument maker Johannes Zumper, quickly took on. They were reasonably easy to construct and cheap to sell, and as you might expect, both J.C. Bach and Abel took advantage of it. And we can assume they gave their first performances of their new pieces for this exciting new instrument at their now famous subscription concerts. Here's an example of one of Abel's piano concertos, played here by David Owen Norris on a restored square piano from 1769, with the violin and cello parts played by the ensemble Sonnery.
Thank you.
David Owen Norris played Carl Friedrich Abel's Piano Concerto in B-flat on a restored square piano from 1769. The violin and cello parts were played by the ensemble Sonnery. You're listening to the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3, and I'm Lucy Skeeping. The 1760s in London was a high point of musical activity, with the flourishing pleasure gardens at Vauxhall, Ranelagh and Marylebone, and the new subscription concerts in Soho run by Abel and J.C. Bach, along with some 80 other venues of various assorted sizes and degrees of musical ambitiousness. Music was an amusing diversion, light and ephemeral, such emotional content as there was worn decorously on a well-trimmed sleeve, readily observed, but of good taste and, above all, well-mannered. I mentioned earlier how many of Haydn's symphonies were given their first English hearings at the famous Bach-Abel concerts. Mind you, the symphony itself was rather a new thing at the time. Its forms and boundaries were still being defined. Most of Europe's leading composers were now beginning to dip their toes into the new genre, and Johann Christian Bach and Carl Friedrich Abel were no exception. J.C. Bach composed more than 30 symphonies, which were said to be a huge influence on the young Mozart, whilst Abel contributed at least 24 to the repertoire. In fact, he was working on his first set of them when the Mozart family came to town. They were staying at the Bach-Abel household, and the young Wunderkind copied out Abel's sixth symphony from that first set, the one in E-flat. He substituted oboes for clarinets, though, which is partly the reason why, for some time, the work was thought to be Mozart's own 18th symphony. Perhaps these days we wouldn't consider Abel's symphonies to be exactly masterpieces, but they are very finely crafted works and clearly had an important influence on the generations that followed him. This is his symphony in E-flat, played by the ensemble Cantilena, directed by Adrian Shepherd.
Thank you. Thank you.
Adrian Shepherd directed the ensemble Cantilena in that symphony in E-flat by Carl Friedrich Abel, the sixth of his Opus 7 set of symphonies, composed in London in 1764. For a time, it was thought to be Mozart's 18th symphony, but it turned out that the young prodigy had merely copied out Abel's work as a boy when he'd been on a visit to London with his father. When J.C. Bach died, the Bach-Abel subscription concerts came to an end, but Abel continued to be in great demand as a player on various instruments, new and old. He toured through Germany and France for a while, but he always returned to London, the city that had given him such a welcome and had provided him with a secure and creative home for more than a quarter of a century. I guess you could call Abel an honorary Londoner. Charles Burney wrote that his musical science and taste were so complete that he became the umpire in all musical controversy, which is a lovely compliment. Enjoying all this success and praise, though, and no doubt hundreds of post-concert drinks parties, Abel had also got himself a bit of a reputation for decadence and excess. In his later years especially, he drank extremely heavily, the sweet wine of the Rhine apparently being his favourite tipple. One contemporary noted how Abel used to drink in shocking quantities, and that his weakness for the best wines ruined his health and his life. One day, in 1787, a sad announcement appeared in the Morning Post. Mr. Abel died, going on to say his favourite instrument, the bass viol, was not in general use and would probably die with him. The musician was just 63, and they were right about the gamba dying with him. The instrument had already become more or less obsolete in the brave new world Abel left behind him. But his legacy as an instrumentalist, a composer and a high flyer on the 18th century London music scene still remains. And thanks to a whole new generation of gamba players, more than 200 years later, we can get a glimpse of the musical world Abel inhabited. I'll leave the final words to Charles Burney, who more than once commented on Abel's ability to breathe the notes as he played them.
Thank you. an air for Viola da Gamba, played by Susanna Heinrich, and ending today's early music show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. You can download the programme if you'd like to. You'll find it via the early music show pages on the Radio 3 website. And Lucy will be back next week to introduce highlights from a concert of Armenian music given in Barcelona by Jordi Savall and his ensemble. That's at the usual time next Sunday, 2 o'clock. Well, it's choral music now on Radio 3 for the next couple of hours. Choral Evensong, of course, in a few moments. And after that, this week's edition of The Choir. Sarah Moore Peach is in charge of that. And I'm glad to say she's just arrived to tell us about it. Sarah.
Well, we've got loads on today, actually. We're talking about national anthems and what makes a good one, what makes it really singable. We've got fascinating research that's been done into the singability of particular tunes. So we'd love to know what your favourite national anthem is. Don't be too patriotic. Perhaps they are further abroad than Britain that you think the best one is. And where would you reckon God Save the Queen would end up in a ranking of most singable national anthems? Let us know on 83111 text number or Twitter at BBC Radio 3. We're also being very Georgian today with Handel Coronation Anthems as our choral classic at 5 o'clock. And Simon Halsey is going to be joining me in the studio to talk about a fantastic new piece by the American composer David Lang called Crowd Out, which is going to involve thousands of singers, and you could be one of them. So do join me at 4 for that.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll look forward to it. Sarah Moore Peach, the choir, at 4 o'clock. Well, now on BBC Radio 3, 3 o'clock, and time for Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast live from the Guild Chapel in Stratford-upon-Avon on Wednesday. The canticles are sung to the second service by Orlando Gibbons, and the anthem, which had its first performance last Wednesday, is a setting by Pete Wire of William Blake's poem Hear the Voice of the Bard. During the prayers, the choir also sings Easter movements from the third part of Handel's Messiah. The service opens now with William Byrd's setting of the Easter antiphon Haec Dies. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Alleluia.
Welcome to the Guild Chapel in Stratford-upon-Avon for this service of Choral Evensong. 450 years ago today, William Shakespeare was born in a house not far from here. He went to school next door and would no doubt have known this chapel well. It was part of the hospital and almshouses of the Guild of the Holy Cross, until the guild was dissolved just a decade or so before Shakespeare's birth. The chapel overlooks the site of New Place, Shakespeare's Stratford home for 19 years, and where he died in April 1616. Stratford welcomes visitors from across the globe who come to discover the place which tells Shakespeare's story from cradle to grave. In this Easter season, Christians throughout the world are celebrating the mighty power of God, which brought to life Jesus Christ from the grave. As St. Paul puts it, Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so that we too might walk in newness of life.
O Lord, open thou our lips,
and
Psalm appointed for today is Psalm 114.
The first lesson is written in the Song of Solomon, chapter 3. By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. I will rise now and go about the city in the streets, and in the broad ways I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchmen that go about the city found me, to whom I said, Saw ye him whom my soul loveth? It was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up, nor awake my love, till he please. Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold, his bed, which is Solomon's, 70 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night.